Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. This is a bit of an ambitious project. Romans is always an ambitious project. And it'll be the first time I've done Romans in a Sunday school setting rather than like a home group setting where you can take your time, be a lot more leisurely. The reason why this came about was one of our months ago, one of our younger members requested it, and our younger member said, "I've only heard Romans taught from a Calvinist point of view. I want to hear it from another point of view." I'm like, "I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means, except for there may be a couple of areas where a focus on election may be the issue." There will be discussions of election in Romans. You can't escape it. You can't escape it in Paul's writings. It's there. It's in our articles. It's there. I don't know what that means for us, but it will be part of the discussion. Although I have seen some discussions of it that get into the weeds more than I think the text really does, or does it in a way that the text doesn't really necessarily support as well. So here's you have before you an outline, a course overview, and we're going to get into chapter one today, hopefully, but we won't get very far into chapter one. I have here at the top of the page Romans 1, 16 through 17. These really are, I think, the thesis statement for the book of Romans. Romans 16 and 17 is the thesis statement for the epistle to the Romans, where Paul says, "I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." And I think most people would agree that this is the thesis statement of Romans. This is really what Romans is all about. There is another view that says the purpose for it of any letter is kind of lined out in those first few verses. So that view would see, and we'll get into this a little bit, verses 2, about 2 through 6, being more of a core thesis statement. I do think 16 and 17 is better, but don't ignore 1 through 6. It's easy to blow off those introductory things. We're going to get into that a little bit as well. Let's just talk a little bit of basic background information. Oh, by the way, this is being recorded. I was also asked to record it, so it is being recorded. I'll send out video links later, which means if you do have questions and discussion, I'm going to have to repeat or summarize those for the video, because everybody doesn't have a microphone, and that's probably a good thing. I know you guys. So let's get into some basic background information. Who is the author? Well, of course, it's St. Paul. And there really is no solid debate on that issue. Anybody that thinks it might be somebody else, they're grasping at straws. They really are. It's very solidly by St. Paul. Again, this is laid out in verses 1 through 5. He's most likely writing from the city of Corinth during his second missionary journey. So that's about 57 or so AD, or sorry, his third missionary journey. How do we know this? Well, because of who he talks about at the end of the book, the people that are carrying the letter to the Romans. We don't have a reliable postal system in ancient Rome. So if you want your letters to get places, you need to send them with people. I'm reading some correspondence between St. Augustine and St. Jerome, and part of the problem in their discussions is that they kept losing their messengers. Their messengers didn't make it a bunch of times, and so there's some miscommunication. So we do know that Paul sends this through Phoebe. You can read about Phoebe in the Acts of the Apostles, as she's mentioned in some of the other letters as well. And he's most likely writing during this third missionary journey, about 57 AD. Again, Phoebe in that context gives us a hint at that, but also some of what's happening in Romans. And this goes to our audience. The audience is to the Christians in Rome, but the text really tells us that we have a mixture of a Jewish and Gentile audience, because he's going to be addressing a lot of issues related to Israel and Jewish believers. and how they relate to the Gentiles. Something that happened a few years before this is that the Jews had been expelled from Rome by the Emperor Claudius. And then a few years later, they were able to come back. So this is after they had come back, but only a couple years after they came back. So they had been expelled for about 5 or 6 years, somewhere there. I didn't write down the exact dates on that. But what probably happens is that the gospel comes to Rome the way the apostles always did things in these early days, is they started in the synagogues because that connection with the Old Testament scriptures and all those promises, that's very much low-hanging fruit, right? This is something that people can relate to. And they start the church from Jewish converts. And a lot of these Jewish converts were still very much practicing a lot of their traditions at that time, which Paul doesn't have an issue with, so long as it's done in the right way. Look at Galatians for some of that issues. But what happens, again, early in the church, we see this right around, what, Acts 11 or so, is that the Gentiles start to come in, and they don't have to become Jewish in their practice to be Christians. So there's built-in cultural tension. When the Jews are expelled from Rome, the church grows, and it's just Gentiles, because there aren't no Jews anymore. When the Jews come back, now you've got the growth of this church without that typical mix that was in most of the cities of the time. And that means there's going to be tensions. So some of that is addressed here in the book. Rome is also the capital city of the empire. That means it's very strategic. It's very cosmopolitan. It's a very important place. Whether it's the most important city, that's another issue. Maybe, maybe not. We'll let the historians deal with that. Doesn't really matter for our study. But it is the capital city, so that means that it's very important. Why was Romans written? Most of the letters we have from Paul are written because there's a problem that he needs to address. It doesn't seem that's the case here. If there is a problem, it might be some of those underlying Jewish and Gentile tensions. But it doesn't seem that that's risen to the point where someone has come to Paul and say, we need you to fix this. That's not what's happening here. Paul did not plant the church in Rome. He's never even been there, we're going to find out. He's never been to Rome. He wants to go to Rome. Why does he want to go to Rome? Well, it looks like in chapter 15 that he wants to go so that he can use Rome as a launching point for ministry further up and further west, particularly into Spain. He wants to go to Spain. Rome's a great place to kind of be a base of operations for this extended ministry. Does that happen? I don't know, to be honest. The book of Acts doesn't really address it, and I don't remember from other history how all that worked out. Paul's third missionary journey, I believe, is his last one. Like, at the end of that's when he gets arrested. He does some more traveling that's not in Acts because he's under house arrest and he doesn't immediately go to get executed, but he doesn't do very much traveling. I think he doesn't really get much farther than Rome, if I recall. I see Lily shaking her head up and down, so I will trust Lily's memory on that as well. There may be some Jewish and Gentile tensions. He wants to use Rome as a base of operations as he goes to Spain. I don't think that ever happens, but that's what he wants. And so in some ways, this letter is an introduction from Phoebe to the Romans saying, this is who I am, you've heard of me. And how is he going to make that introduction? By really giving a full expression of his theology. He's going to give us the gospel, and we get that really in its fullest form in Romans. It's not everything, though. There are some key things that we find in, like, Colossians and Philippians regarding the person of Christ that aren't in here. This is not a systematic theology letter, but it's pretty full. And again, we're going to see how that works as well. So let's go to the course outline, how we're going to divide this up. My goal is, other than today, to hit a chapter a week, which puts us at about 16 or 17 weeks. To be honest, that's an ambitious goal. We'll see how that goes, but that's the hope. Because you could easily spend years in Romans. Famously, the Presbyterian preacher Martin Lloyd-Jones, I think he did 3.5 years preaching series through Romans. We're not going to do that. You could do Romans, you know, in a much higher level and even do it in just in fewer weeks than this, but we're gonna basically try to hit about a chapter a week. The organization that I have here and given before you, I am indebted to the Gospel Coalition's podcast, Help Me Teach the Bible, hosted by a wonderful gal named Nancy Guthrie. This episode, I forgot to write down who basically she interviews a scholar, an expert, a pastor on each book, and they kind of break down how you're going to teach a particular book. It's a great series. I always recommend to anybody that's going to be leading a study, go to that series. Doesn't mean we agree with everything that they say all the time. There's a significant place where I think the fellow got it not wrong. I just think I think frankly his Presbyterianism was coloring his read on that in a way that is not as faithful to the text as it could be. But it's a great podcast, and this breakdown, large picture breakdown of Romans comes from him. So the first five chapters, Paul is really going to spell out the gospel. This is where we get that fullness of his gospel theology. Today, chapter one, we're going to look at his introduction, and then after that, and that thesis statement, that introduction, both his personal one, his to the Romans, but also the introduction of the gospel itself, and then he gets into God's wrath on humanity and why humanity deserves it. Chapter two, he says, oh, by the way, you religious Jews are not exempt from God's wrath. And that's going to be a big argument in chapter two, that his judgment is righteous, even for those who are trying to be righteous under the law without Christ. Chapter three is going to be, spends half of the chapter on the effects of sin. So 3.5 chapters before we get to really the gospel. We don't get the good news for 3.5 chapters. We get an introduction in 1:16-17. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the bad news before we get into the good news. But we do finally get to defining justification in chapter three. This is an area I recently heard, actually just yesterday or the day before, a Lutheran scholar responding to the Catholic scholar Bishop Barron on Bishop Barron basically trying to tear down Protestant understandings of justification. And it's very clear when you listen to Bishop Barron on this, as is the norm among our Roman Catholic friends, they have not put the picture together in context. Like, it's kind of a, you know, Protestants do this too, everybody does this. You're playing a little bit of a connect the dots all over the New Testament without seeing, okay, when Paul talks about justification, what does he actually say here? Don't bring in James until you've unpacked Paul, right? You know, for example. We'll talk about that in chapter three. We're not going to harp on the Roman Catholic understanding, but we do need to say there's a reason why this letter is so important to our tradition, the Lutherans, anybody that's a son of the Reformation. And we do not need to be ashamed of that, Anglicans. This is part of who we are. It's in our articles. Okay. Chapter four, we're going to bring in Abraham and David and the issue of faith. That's going to be important to that discussion of justification as well. Chapter five, peace with God through faith. Now, chapter 6-11, and I think this is a really neat idea. This is one that I did get from that podcast. These are all answering objections to what Paul says. Paul is anticipating his audience's objections. What a great teacher to do that, by the way, right? I mean, that's how we should be doing things, including those common objections that come from people that really freak out by this idea that we are justified by faith. And he's gonna answer all those objections. The first one is basically that, hey, if this is true, can I just do whatever I want? If we're, you know, that everybody brings that up, right? Next, okay, well, if this is true, what do we need the law for? What good is the law? That's chapter 7. Then chapter 8, what about the future? I know me, and I know how things are going in my life and my sin. That makes me sound like that I might not really be justified. Is God really in my corner? He's going to talk about that in chapter 8. Chapter 8 is glorious, by the way. Chapter 9 through 11 is addressing the issue of Israel. This is the area where I think sometimes the some parts of the Reformed tradition miss the point sometimes. Is it about election? Yes, but it's not that it's about election and Israel is the illustration of that. It's actually about Israel, with election being a part of how that's understood. That's what the text says. chapters 12 through 15, practical holy living. What does it mean to live as a Christian? Okay, we're justified by faith, but that doesn't mean we're off the hook for living like Christians, right? And so chapters 12 through 13 is going to talk about that. 12, living as part of the Christian body. 13, living as part of a hostile world, including when we have a hostile government. That's a big part of chapter 13. That'll be fun. Chapter 14, the weaker brother, Christian judgment. What does it look like as a Christian to judge in the right way? It's not as simple as bringing in judge not and you shall not, lest ye be judged. There's a lot more to the picture than that, right? And that's what chapter 14 is about, particularly within the church. Okay, chapter 15, he's going to again talk about those relationships between Jews and Gentiles in Christ. What do you do when you have those tensions? What does that look like living together despite those big differences culturally? And then the rest of 15 and 16, he's going to talk about his itinerary. Again, don't miss that. That tells us a lot about Paul when he talks about his plans and his itinerary. Okay, so that's the big overview. I'm going to pause real quick. Anything we want to talk about before we move on to getting into the beginning of chapter 1? All right, let's get into chapter 1. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his Son, who was descended from David according to the flesh, and was declared to be the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord, through whom we have received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of faith for the sake of his name among all the nations, including you who are called to belong to Jesus Christ. To all those in Rome who are loved by God and called to be saints, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. So why do some people say, hey, this gives us a clue of what Romans is about? Well, because he's connecting the gospel to the old promises. That's a big point of what Paul wants to say in Romans. Again, I don't think that's the central point, but that's a really big part of what Romans is going to be talking about. This is not a new story, the gospel. This is a very old story being fulfilled. This is the way the story was always going to go. God doesn't have a plan B in the scriptures. This was the way it was always supposed to be. We weren't on Judaism, and then we went off track to Christianity. No, this is the way the story was always supposed to go, says St. Paul. Any deviation from that story is just that. It's a deviation. So this, the gospel going to all nations through the Son of God was the way it was supposed to be, as a fulfillment of the prophet, what the prophet said, the promises beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures concerning his Son. It was always about Jesus. It was always about the Messiah, God's Son, the Son of David, the promises. Declared the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness. What's Paul hinting at there? The Trinity has always been biblical. We might not have fully understood it, but it's always been there, right? This Trinitarian understanding is important, and we see this in the life of Jesus himself, his resurrection from the dead, and it's through him that we received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of sake for his name among nations. He sent us to do this. It's, again, all about Jesus. And he says, to those in Rome who are loved by God and called to be saints. His audience, the Romans, are called by God, loved by God, called to be saints. By extension, so are we. The gospel is not just for the unbeliever, it's for you too. It's actually more for us believers than it is for the unbeliever. And that's a big part of what Paul's going to be saying throughout the book, is that no, the gospel is always for you, and it remains for you. All of this good news in chapters 1 through 5 is not just to bring unbelievers here. You don't, okay, now that I've got the gospel, I'm good, I'm on my own. That's not the way it is. The grace of God is always part of who we are as Christians. Matter of fact, it's foundational for who we are. All this other stuff will never work out without that grace. The grace of God is always part of it. Okay, verse 8 through 15. Paul desires to go to Rome. He says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. That's pretty neat. He's heard about them. He doesn't know them yet, but he's heard about them. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will I may now at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. That is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I want you to know, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. I am under obligation both to Greeks and barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So I'm eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. He wants to come. He's been prevented. When does he actually get to Rome? Y'all remember? When he's in prison. That's right. Yeah, on a prison ship. That's right. He spends most of his time in Rome under house arrest. But he does end up doing just this when he finally gets there. It doesn't happen the way he seems to want it to happen, but God is doing what he's going to do. So he's heard of their faith. They've got a great reputation among all the Christians throughout the world, and he's praying for them. Be praying for your brothers and sisters, even those you don't know about, or you don't know personally, rather. That's an important part of the church. What it means to be part of the church is to be part of that big body, connected by prayer as well as by what our Lord has done for us. Mutual encouragement, that's what fellowship is for. I always do like to visit some of the other parishes because there always is some mutual encouragement. I miss y'all when I'm gone, but it's good to get that mutual encouragement, right? And I hope the same is true when we have some of the other guys visit here. And then that desire to visit and preach in Rome, which again doesn't come until later. And then we get to what I do think is the thesis statement of the letter, verses 16 and 17. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Greek in this context is shorthand for Gentile, right? For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. So it is the gospel that is the power of God to salvation. Don't be ashamed of the gospel. Don't think that you can meet the times and change for the sake of things. By the way, that never works. The folks that many of us have come from, they've been saying that they're going to meet the times for the last 50 years, and they've just gotten grayer and older, and they're dying. You know, they're like, we're going to meet the young people by changing. The young people don't care. The world doesn't care when Christians look like the world. It doesn't make the world happy. It might make the world pat itself on the back, but it's not going to make them come into church. Stick to the gospel. That's what makes us different. That's what God uses to spread salvation, not that other stuff. This phrase here, the righteousness of God, this is very interesting. The Greek there is, it could be construed in a lot of different ways. And the ESV, what I'm reading from, basically does it in the most literal way possible. It's a very safe way. What does of mean here? I agree with Martin Luther and so many others that this is really talking about the righteousness that belongs to God. That he reveals his righteousness from faith to faith. This is not the righteousness that we have because of God. Now later we're going to see that he gives us that righteousness. But it's not our righteousness so that we can get to God. This is actually God's righteousness that the gospel is proclaiming. And here's a question. We're not going to get to this week. But if the gospel is by grace through faith, if it is a gift from God to declare you righteous, we're going to talk about that's what justification means later on, that declaration. At least in Paul, that's the way it's being used. This is legal forensic language. If you are a guilty sinner, and you are, and so am I, but God says, no, I'm going to declare you righteous. How can God be righteous in that declaration? A judge that lets somebody off who's guilty, that's not a righteous judge. God's reputation is on the line. That's part of the scandal of the gospel. It does get solved. We're not going to solve it today, but that issue does get addressed. It does get solved. But this idea of the righteousness of God is key to that. That Paul is actually saying that, no, God's reputation is on the line here, but the gospel does show God to be righteous as well. And we'll get to that. And then it says here, for in the gospel, in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. Okay. Faith is how we receive God's promises. It's the means by which we receive God's promises. It is not the basis of God's promises. What do I mean by that? You don't have God's promises because you really, really, really believe them. Your belief has nothing to do whether God's promises are true or not. Faith is the way you receive his promises. His promises are there. His promises are the picture. Faith is the way we receive it. There is nothing inherently righteous about your faith. Your faith in of itself isn't anything. But God has made your faith the way that you receive the gift. The faith is not the gift. The faith does not make him give you the gift. Faith is the way you reach out to get the gift. That's important. And again, the gospel here is for believers also, not only for the non-Christian. Okay, a few minutes before we close up. Comments, questions. This is a big letter. If you have not read it through recently, do so. Preferably in as few settings as possible. If you listen to it on an audio Bible, it's maybe an hour, if that. So it's worth it, because that will help you see the way the argument unfolds. But any questions, any thoughts, any pushbacks? Randy?
Well, I think it's very refreshing. You know that verse 16, the last 5 or 10 years, the priority of the Jews first has been a lot more than reaching and being aware of it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a bit, especially once we get into chapters 9 through 11, where it talks about here, the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, also to the Greek. What does that mean? We're going to unpack that a little bit. There is a bit of a gospel priority, but I think there's two mistakes that could be made. One is forgetting that the gospel here is to the Jew first. That's one mistake to make. That's a mistake that a lot of the church has made. There are significant portions of the church that says, hey, Jews are saved by their obedience to the law. They don't need the gospel. No, actually, they do need the gospel. You know, Paul, who was the Hebrew of the Hebrews, the greatest Israelite, you know, in terms of the way he talks about it, you know, he says, no, they do. You know, Jesus, who was really the true Israelite, is the Messiah of Israel. So that's mistake number one. Mistake number two is ignoring the, and also to the Greek. I come from some Messianic circles when I was younger, and 15 years in the Messianic movement. And that can be a thing where that's a pathology that is not uncommon in that world, is to basically say to the Jew only, and that's not what the text says either. So we do have a whole mission, but we are going to talk about why there is a priority in this presentation here, the way Paul puts it. All right, anything else? Anybody else? Very good, Randy. Thank you. All right, guys, next week we're going to finish out Chapter 1, talk about some things that are very uncomfortable in today's culture. All right, God bless y'all.